This is David Bell, and today you'll be listening to part two of an interview that I did with Doris Cannon, a victim advocate with the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office. Doris just retired after almost 30 years of service, and I was certainly looking forward to interviewing her, and I'm glad that I got a chance to. In the first episode, we talked about Doris's background and her personal experiences, including being a victim of domestic violence herself. We then talked about her career choice to become a victim advocate, what she saw there, and how her personal experiences influenced how she dealt with victims. In this episode, we are going to explore more of the cases that stayed with her and more of the conflicts that happened within the domestic violence system. Domestic violence cases are difficult because they represent the intersection between crime and family relationships. What does the victim want? What does the offender want? What does society want? How does a prosecutor prove her case when the victim doesn't want to testify? What if the victim will testify but doesn't want her partner to go to jail? Should the system listen to the victim's voice in those situations? And when should what society want override that voice? Thank you for joining us for part two of this interview with Doris Cannon. Doris, when we left off, we were talking about victims testifying. Did you sometimes want a victim to testify when she didn't want to?
Yes.
And why would that happen?
We had a policy in our office that even if the victim was uncooperative, and we felt like we had a winning case against a defendant, we would serve that victim with a subpoena, which is a court order that requires her to be in court. And we would make her get on the stand and talk about what happened. Sometimes she would downplay the abuse. Sometimes she would out and out deny it. It wasn't just her testimony that we had as evidence. We had to have other evidence. We got a lot of flack from the domestic violence shelters in the area because they felt like she had been told what to do all this time and we were taking another right from her. We were in the business of prosecuting criminals. And even though she may not have considered that her husband, her boyfriend, whomever, a criminal, he had committed a criminal act. And so we did what we did, and we would, you know, help her to come to court and get on the stand and testify. Sometimes she would tell the truth about what happened, but it didn't win us any brownie points in doing that with her nor the shelter, and of course not with his family. But we did what we felt we had to do. And it wasn't about winning a case. That wasn't what it was. It was about maybe protecting her. Maybe if she got away from him for a little while, then maybe she would get some counseling to help her to understand why she stayed in this particular abusive relationship. A lot of times we did it for the sake of the children because domestic violence can be a learned behavior. And so we just kind of felt like, if he weren't there, or if she weren't there, then maybe it gave the kids a fighting chance. Maybe they would feel safe being at home. And so we did that not out of spite or anything like that, but because we had a case and we needed to hold that defendant accountable for what he did.
But do you ever think that in forcing someone to appear, and because once you're subpoenaed, if you don't appear, you could be arrested.
Right.
Body attachment. Forcing someone to take the stand, as much as there's a good intention there, potentially in hoping she leaves, hoping this is the moment she stands up and looks her abuser in the eye and says, I'm out, that could potentially cause overall more harm. And I know we're weighing harm against harm, Doris, and I'm not suggesting I know the answer to here, but I'm just pointing out the obvious, that there's a certain harm there you talked about potentially. It could be viewed as taking away a little bit of agency maybe from her, but also the trauma that it would be from subjecting her to that. And I'm just trying to understand maybe in a broader context now that you're not in the prosecutor's office, how you may view that situation.
I think you're right about that. I think that some cases we had did cause that victim more harm because perhaps he was the main breadwinner. And so we took that away from her. We took that father from his children. You know, I would hear things like, he's a good father. He does things with the kids. My thought has always been, well, how can he be a good father? And he's beating up the mother. But I did understand what they were saying. sometimes they hated me. I mean, that's just a fact. Sometimes they hated me because of my job. And so in doing that harm and having her, and I had them ask me the question, what am I to do now? You've taken away everything. I didn't have an answer for that. I mean, what was she to do now? And I told her I was sorry, but maybe it might help you to look inside yourself and realize what you gave up to be in this abusive relationship. Was that an answer? It was not. I wasn't going to be able to be the breadwinner of that family. I couldn't be a father to those children. But at the end of the day, I had a job to do.
Sure.
And so I did it.
You know, in my experience, and you know, you and I worked together for a long time, worked opposed or with, however you want to describe it. I was a public defender when I first met you, and I appreciate certainly the education that you provided to me and kind of being patient with me at that time. But most cases plead out.
Yes.
And so I want the listeners to understand that this wasn't happening in every single instance throughout all the cases that came through Jackson County. My guess would be that a victim's desire to stay with someone or their individual situation would likely be taken into account in a plea offer. The times I went to trial against you and your office when you were there usually was horrific injuries.
Mm-mm.
I mean, broken bones and,
right.
and multiple broken bones and significant facial injuries, orbital fractures and things like that.
Right.
Most of the cases, however, that I had were dealt out with in some form of probation, actually.
Yes, yes.
And I assume in those situations, all of these individual characteristics were taken into account.
They were. We did not. I know I made it sound like, you know, we took a lot of cases to trial.
Right.
We did not. And like you said, we played out a lot of cases. My job was also to get input from those victims. What would you like to see happen in this case? And a lot of times she wanted to keep that family together. And a lot of times against our better judgment, we gave those defendants probation. The thing about it was that she just felt that if he got counseling, everything would be all right. We've heard time and time again that the first step in getting help is to admit that you have a problem and you need help. Well, in this way, we were forcing him to get help. It wasn't that he said, I want to get help. We made that a special condition of his probation that he goes into domestic violence counseling, that he get that help. Did we see them as repeat? Sometimes, yes, we did, because what the victim failed to realize is that, yes, we can order him into counseling, but that doesn't mean that he's going to heed the advice of the counselor or if he's even going to admit that he had a problem. And so when we would see them back, I established a rapport with a lot of these victims. So a lot of times we would just sit and talk. And, you know, sometimes they admitted that counseling didn't work, and I wish it did work. When we saw them back, are we going to give them probation again? Unfortunately, sometimes we had to, because she was the only witness and evidence that we had. But at the end of the day, I think that some of them just want, as females, you know, we were taught to grow up, get married, have kids, you know, keep a home. And I think that so many times that's what these victims wanted. They just wanted that home life, that life that they dreamed of as a child. And the reality of it is they didn't always get that life.
I was wondering if you could tell me about a case or a victim that stayed with you even to this point.
When I first started, there was a defendant and a victim that we had, and he had beat her up just terribly. And we took that case to trial. It ended in a hung jury. And so we were going to retry it. And she couldn't go through it again. She said she could not go through and tell what he had done in front of 12 complete strangers again. We had to end up dismissing that case. But what he didn't realize was that I remembered him, and I remembered how this victim looked, and I remembered talking to her and just how downtrodden she was. I remembered that. A couple, 3 years later, we had him again, and it was really interesting. I should point out that the first victim, the police stopped him for a traffic violation. And when they went to the car, she was on the passenger side. He had beaten her so badly, they didn't even think it was a human. Mm. And that's why it stuck with me so much. And even though, you know, we had to end up dismissing that case, I remembered him. And so when he came across my desk again, I was like, oh, okay, I remember him. And so I spoke with that victim. She was cooperative. The things that he made her do, we held a preliminary hearing. You know, a preliminary hearing establishes probable cause that a crime was committed and that he committed the crime. And so we had a preliminary hearing on that. And the courtroom was full. And she got on that stand and she talked about the most horrible things that he made her do and that he did to her. Some of the things that he made her do, he would bring prostitutes in and force her to have sex with them. He would beat her if she acted like she didn't like it. He would beat her if she acted like she liked her. So she was in a no-win situation. And she went through that process, and he was bound over for trial. And she said the same things at trial that she had said in the preliminary hearing. And she went through that, and she told this in front of 12 strangers, and he was convicted. We kept in touch for years afterwards. For years, she would call me. She moved to another city in Missouri, but she would call me. And she would keep in contact with me. As a result of her being with him, she developed AIDS. And I felt horrible for her because she had endured so much from him. And then she was diagnosed with this disease. But I haven't talked to her in a long, long time. I have not forgotten her at all. So some cases stick with you. Because we couldn't get justice for his first victim, I am so glad that we were able to get justice for this one.
Have you ever felt empathy for an abuser during any of these proceedings?
I have. I don't think that I haven't. Well, there have been some that, you know, I just thought that they were horrible people and needed to go away. But I have felt empathy for a lot of defendants because you see them. Defense attorneys would tell us the type of life that they've had, that they've struggled with. I think as a human being, if you can't empathize with someone who's had a rough life, then that says a lot about you as a person. And so I did feel empathy. And I did feel bad because some of the things that they've had to struggle with. But even in feeling that empathy, I just felt like you could have addressed these problems that you had a long time ago. You didn't have to do this to this person. And those were the, you know, defendants that said, I know I need help. Well, why did it wait until you got to the criminal justice system to get help? Why didn't you address these issues when you were out there? Why didn't you seek the help that you feel like you need now before it got to this point? And so even in empathizing with them, I still felt you could have prevented this. You could have sought help. You didn't have to let it get this far.
What are the main things you've learned as a survivor of domestic abuse and also as a domestic violence advocate with the prosecutor's office? It's the things that you want people to know about.
I think what I learned from my own personal experience is I was stronger than what I thought I was, and that I retained a level of respect for myself, and that I did not have to put up with certain things in a relationship. My experience in the domestic violence unit, I learned an interesting thing. I learned that some women, and this is horrible to say, but I learned that some women like that type of relationship, that some women feel like a man doesn't love them unless they're being hit. One victim told me when I was saying, you can do better, you don't have to live like this. And she said, you know what, Miss Cannon, sometimes you stick with what you know. And so, in other words, I know him. I know he's an abuser, but the next one that I meet may be worse than this one. That has stuck with me after all these years. That has stuck with me. I've learned that you can only help people who want to be helped, and that there were some people I was not able to help. I learned that sometimes, when you offer resources to people, they don't always want to take advantage of it. But I also learned that people have free will and that they are going to do what they want to do, regardless of the consequences of that decision. But I've also learned to respect the decisions that these victims made. I may have been a victim of domestic abuse, but those were my shoes, and I have to allow them to walk in their own shoes. And so no matter what I may wish for them, no matter how much I may wish that they would get out of that relationship, they are walking in their own shoes. And so I had to learn to respect that, no matter how I felt about it. Because me talking to them and me passing judgment on them, I think they've had enough judgment passed against them. So even when I had those victims to say, I'm not going to follow through with it, I'm not going to cooperate with them, and I want him back home, no matter how badly I felt, I had to respect that decision from them.
We are speaking with Doris Cannon, victim advocate for almost 30 years at the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office. When we return, we will explore what factors go into whether a prosecutor's office will seek probation versus prison. We're speaking with Doris Cannon, victim advocate for almost 30 years at the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office. We're going to talk now about punishment. On the defendant's side, Doris, what's your take on probation versus incarceration for offenders? Is there some sense of that you have of when one is right over the other?
The defendant that I spoke about a few minutes ago, the one that had abused this woman so terribly. Like anyone that commits a crime, sometimes incarceration is the only answer for them, that they cannot live productively in society because they just won't, that they will keep committing crimes. And so I think people like that need to go to prison. I don't get any joy in saying that. It's just a reality. On the other hand, I think that there are those who deserve a second chance, maybe even a third chance. That, you know, abuse is abuse. So I'm not saying this abuse is worse than this abuse. But I think that if they are willing to get help, know they have a problem, really want to do better, then I think that, yeah, then they deserve a chance.
You know, when I have clients come to me, defendants that come to me and victims that come to me, I always want to get them into counseling. Mm-hmm. Whether a defendant says it happened or didn't happen, whatever the victim said, because at a minimum, there was a traumatic enough event that the police were called.
Right.
And at a minimum, we're in the criminal justice system now. Mm-hmm. The police, in my experience, generally aren't out there looking for domestic violence right. to arrest. They're responding to someone calling them.
Absolutely.
And so there's something going on in that relationship mm-hmm. that needs to be addressed.
Right.
At a minimum, it's this, whatever this arguing is, at even more so, certainly physical violence. Mm-mm. And that seems to be the start of it. I certainly have struggled with it because I don't want a defendant that I represent to go out, and if he's done it once, I certainly don't want him to do it again. I don't want to see anybody else in pain. But at the same time, I part of me, Doris, looks to not necessarily who the person is before me, but who they can be, mm-mm, the potential in a positive way of who they can. And sometimes I find myself focusing on that person rather than the reality of what's in front of me.
You know, it's interesting that you use that word potential, because I know a young lady who was in a domestic violence relationship. She was not raised in a domestic violence home. And she has such a good heart just naturally that she tends to see the good in people and want to move on with the good that's in them. And I had the opportunity to talk with her. And one of the words that she used was, he has potential. He was an abuser, but she saw the potential in him. And I remember saying, it doesn't matter how much potential he has. If he's not willing to work on that potential, why are you? Why are you staying with him just because you see potential in him? And so I thought about it after we had spoken, and I realized that a lot of victims, that's their thought process. He has potential. I see that potential that he has. But you know what? Potential is all nice and well. But if that person don't see the potential in themselves, then it's not going to work.
Yeah, and my hope is, certainly, I agree. And my hope is going to therapy, or sending, having a client go to therapy, that they will understand that the therapist will hopefully do the job that lighting the same torch you're talking about. Mm-hmm. The individual that is abusing, I think a lot of times, is projecting out pain that they have that is unresolved in them in some capacity. And so my hope is that whatever lights within them to understand, hey, there's a better way, not just for the individual you're harming, but for yourself too, to maybe lead a more enjoyable life. I certainly want that. I have to wonder, Doris, have your personal and professional experiences influenced the way you navigate personal relationships yourself?
Oh, absolutely. For one thing, when I worked at the prosecutor's office, I had to be very careful about relationships. I couldn't afford to involve myself in a relationship that may potentially come back to bite me. And so I knew people who worked at the police department, and I would just give them a call and say, I just need to know if you can tell me if this person has ever been arrested for, you know, and if the arrest was for domestic violence. And, you know, in dating, I would tell these men, I inquired about your past criminal history. And some of them would get really mad and just say, you know, you crossed the line. I don't want to be bothered. And that was fine. And then some of them, you know, they were like, well, I don't have anything, so I really don't care. But absolutely, it just makes you, domestic violence, you know, growing up, and I don't know if you ever heard this, what goes on in your house stays in your house. I believe that to be true to a certain point. If something bad is going on in the house, then you need to tell someone. And so I am a firm believer. I need to know. I need to know who you are. I need to know if you have a criminal history. I've had defendants hit on me before. I'm like, do you realize you've been charged with domestic violence? And I work in that unit, and I know your history. And it was like, well, it's all good, though, you know. And so it's made me really leery, even to this day, about having a relationship, because it's that trust. You have to have that trust. You have to be committed to have a relationship. And I'm kind of like, yeah, I don't know if I'm ready to trust again. And mine happened years ago.
Do you think, based on your experience with the victims that you've worked with, probably thousands at this point, the thousands of defendants that you've seen, that when you come across some person that you want to get to know or that wants to get to know you, that you are able to identify them as a potential abuser? Meaning, how do you know, right? You go to the criminal background check, but then if domestic violence is rarely reported in a lot of relationships, then that's not going to help you. Is there a way for you to know, or is it just like, you know, you just hope for the best? I don't know. What do you do?
I don't go into it hoping for the best. There are red flags, and anyone who's even semi-controlling, anyone who praises women but have negative things to say about women, anyone who feels like women should know their place. You know, I like to talk, and so when I'm talking, I'm going to ask questions just to see where their mind is. And so there have been men that I'm like, I don't need to go out with this person because there's just something about them. I have to trust my gut.
Sure.
So when I do that and I'm like, I don't think this will be good for me, then I don't have any problem saying, you know, I don't think this is going to work out. And so you just kind of get to that point. I think that years and years of being in the system and working with the system, you just kind of get a hunch. And so I feel like at times I'm better off just enjoying my own company than with someone who I may be interested in, but there's something about that person that I don't trust.
You know, we've talked about the attitudes towards women in domestic violence situations that surrounded you growing up. We've talked about how society has changed since, at least hopefully making some progress, and about your personal experiences as well as your career. And I know when we had talked before that one of the things that caught my attention was that you told me about a close friend who you had known for many years that found herself in a similar situation. And you knew about this person. This person had grown up in a much better informed environment. This person had all the educational and legal tools that weren't available to you at the time. And yet you later learned that this person was subject to domestic violence, that she was not immune to it. When I look at a situation like that, where someone who was well-informed, well-educated, had all the opportunities to know, and yet it happens, it makes me feel powerless, right? To a certain extent, it's just me just hearing about it. What do you say in a situation like that to the community, the outside? Like, it's almost as if there's nothing we can do in a way. How do you address that?
Well, David, first of all, an abuser is not going to let you know that they're an abuser right offhand. You know, to my knowledge, my belief is that an abuser is not going to hurt you on your first date. And so you meet someone and you just feel like you all click. And so you get more and more comfortable with this person. Victims are just not someone who may live in undesirable neighborhoods. Victims are not just someone that, you know, make these police reports. Anyone can be a victim, but not everyone reports it. People, you know, as we were talking earlier, people who may be married to very wealthy people, live in great neighborhoods, kids go to private schools, they're not really going to report abuse because they're not going to want to lose what they have. But understand that your coworker, your boss may be a victim of domestic violence, because one of the things that these abusers know is that once you get comfortable in a relationship with you, then slowly but surely they can start showing you who they really are. And before you know it, you're caught up in something you hadn't expected to be caught up in. For instance, the one I was telling you about, you know, all the resources available, education, didn't start off being in an abusive relationship, but maybe one day she may have said something or did something that he doesn't like. It may start off with verbal abuse. Oh, that's stupid of you, because that's also, you know, a form of abuse. But then you let it, you know, he apologizes and you let it go and you think, that probably was stupid for me to do that. So maybe the next time, and it may not happen for weeks, months afterwards, and then he slaps you. And then you're just shocked. I can't believe you did that to me. And then the apology comes. Baby, I'm so sorry I did that. I don't know what happened. You know I love you, you know, and he's taking her in his arms and kissing on her and apologizing. He may even be crying because abusers also cry. So she's crying, he's crying, you know, and she feels like, oh, he really didn't mean it. And maybe I did something to bring that on. And then as time goes on and they're together and the abuse gets worse and she finds herself in a relationship that she's unhappy in, but she doesn't know how to get out of. Well, even though I said earlier that when a woman, a victim, woman or man, leaves a DV relationship, that's when she's at her most dangerous because that power, he no longer has that power and control. And so I've had to talk with victims about safe ways to leave. And so some of the things that I told them was to take some of your clothes, some of your kids' clothes, take them to a friend's house or a relative's house. You know, not enough so that he knows that something's missing, but just enough in case you have to leave, you will have a change of clothes. Hide money in places that maybe he won't think to look. You know, be that maybe your sanitary box. Put money away. Give it to a friend. Tell them to hold on to it for safekeeping. Anything, maybe if you're here on a visa, take that visa and put it somewhere, because one of the things that they do is hide that from victims and tell them you can't leave. I will call the authorities. You don't have a visa, things like that. But I'll talk to someone. Don't keep this hidden. Talk to someone you know you can trust, not someone who's going to get out there and tell all of your business. Let someone know what's going on. If you have bruises on you, and a lot of times they won't hit you in your face, especially if you're working in a professional area, but maybe your back, your stomach, if you have bruises, have someone take pictures of that so that there is proof that this is what I've suffered. And in talking to her, let her know she's not alone, that you care about her, that you don't want to see this happen to her. But one thing that you have to do is let it be her decision. As much as I wanted to say, come on, we're leaving here, right, and you don't have to put up with this, that's my decision. It has to be her decision, because as long as it's my decision, she may think, oh, I left him because of you, because you encouraged me to leave him, even though I really didn't want to. So make sure it's her decision, because if it's her decision, then she's going to know, okay, it's time for me to leave, and I made this decision.
You know, Doris, and I appreciate that answer. As you were saying that, I couldn't help but think that my question, the way I phrased it, was, of course, focusing once again on what she can do. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten known you for 20 years now. I've learned a lot about you. And of course, after all this, even the show, I'm looking to her as to what she can do, when mm-hmm. in fact, it's not her doing the abusing. Right. It's the guy doing the abusing. And the question really is what we can do, what I can do to make sure that my child doesn't grow up, hopefully, to be someone who expresses himself in violence in a relationship, and to make sure that when I see those behaviors myself in men particularly, but some women, but particularly men, that I call them out when they happen. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And to the extent with my clients, which I do, that I make sure they get into treatment right away, not only to help with their legal case, but frankly, to hopefully make sure that they don't come back again as clients.
Right. And I understood how you phrased the question, because sometimes women do need to know how to prepare to leave a relationship. Know that sometimes it's just going to happen. Sometimes women are just successful women, or even women who aren't that successful. We all want to be loved. And so sometimes you meet a person and you click and you fall in love with them, and then you find out, okay, they're not quite who I thought they were. And then you find yourself having no way out. And even with men, abuse happens. Sometimes men are victims. I know of one particular case where I had a male victim. Him and his wife or girlfriend had come home from being out, and he laid on the couch to take a nap while she was preparing dinner. He woke up smelling, you know, what he thought was food. It was really him, because she had thrown hot grease on him.
Oh my gosh.
He didn't cooperate with us. And so that love, and I would tell victims, I can't compete with love. I just can't. But I think that when you don't call someone out on something, when you know that it's wrong, then you empower them to keep doing the same thing that they're doing. And so I'm quick to, I've always kind of been kind of bold. So
I would agree with that statement.
I'm quick to say, excuse me, you know, why are you talking to her like that and whatnot? But domestic violence is still very real. I can't even say that it's gone down, because it's starting younger and younger. You have it now in middle school. You know, you have people going out talking to middle school students saying this is not acceptable behavior. You have it in high school, and it's just going to keep on happening. I don't know if there's an answer to it. I can't tell you how to stop it. All I can say is that if you know you have a problem, then I encourage that person to get help before it gets to the extent that you're hurting someone that you claim to care about or love.
Doris, first of all, thank you for education you provided me over the last, well, since 01, when I started as the public defender's office until now. And certainly thank you for your patience. And then thank you for taking the time to open up to us today.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for asking me. You know, even though I have retired now, and I'm kind of sort of lady of leisure, I still, you know, I still see women. Sometimes I'm at the store, sometimes at the service station, and I look at them and I see emptiness and, you know, or, you know, and he's around or whatnot. And I'm like, she's a victim. But I've learned not to say anything and just say a prayer for them and go on.
This is David Bell. We've talked today with Doris Cannon, retired victim advocate with the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office.